Spielberg presents Back to the Future, a Robert Zemeckis film. Marty leads an ordinary life.
No McFly ever amounted to anything in the history of Hill Valley.
Well, history is going to change.
And 1985 is not his year. But Dr. Brown is about to change all that.
Psst. What does it all like me? Slow down. Okay. What?
He's sending Marty 30 years back in time.
It worked!
It's a flying saucer from outer space!
Hey, you're Michael Jordan. I think you're the greatest basketball player that ever lived, honest. It's like meeting Lincoln or something.
Back to the Future.
Are you telling me that this sucker is nuclear?
Precisely.
Michael J. Fox.
Whoa, this is heavy.
Christopher Lloyd.
There's that word again, heavy. Why are things so heavy in the future? Is there a problem with the Earth's gravitational pull?
Back to the Future.
Oh, that's right. You're home. Fuck.
Yeah. I've been home for a little while.
Is that because of the surgery, or did you have the surgery in Russia?
No. I definitely wouldn't have surgery in Russia. No offense to the Russians. I'm sure they do great work. But no, I had it here in D.C. So yeah, I've been home for 5-6 months now.
All righty.
Yeah.
Are you going insane? Are you still in a cast?
I'm not in a cast anymore. I've basically gotten back to normal life. So thankfully the insanity and all the painkillers that make you loopy, all that is behind me now. So I'm happy.
You know, I hate painkillers, even recreationally. I never got into them. People love them, though.
Yes, people do love them. It's rather strange.
Just so you know, Joe, I'm already recording.
Okay.
And essentially, if we want to get into areas that you don't want to be put up on the net, we can
right.
take anything out.
Right.
So sometimes if the conversation is going well and you feel comfortable talking to us but not going on the air, we just take care of that while I edit it.
Okay, cool. Yeah, and I trust you guys to, not put up anything that makes you look ridiculous. So.
Absolutely. Because sometimes certain details are important for the conversation, and yeah, you get it.
Yeah.
Let's see. I think Alan is, I hope Alan didn't drown. I think Asheville got hit by a huge storm.
Oh, did it?
Yeah, I saw a picture of pretty massive flooding.
Have you seen, has he been on the goddamn Facebook?
The GDFB?
He's in North Carolina?
Yeah, he just moved there from New York, so.
A pit stop in Virginia.
Okay, well, he posted 19 hours ago was the last time anyone's heard from him, so, here. So, I don't know. Wow, I can't believe he's in North Carolina. My sister's in North Carolina. I don't know if they would jive, though, necessarily.
I've talked to, like, 3 people in the last week who live or know people who live in Asheville. So, I guess it's kind of got a little hippie vibe to it. So it's kind of welcoming.
Oh, yeah. I knew a guy who ran a pirate radio station. I was living at a yoga center, and this guy, he swore by it. He loved Asheville. My old boss from the cab company I used to work for moved there, too. Although I don't think he moved to Asheville, but he moved to North Carolina. I think a lot of people who are hip in North Carolina, even if they don't live in Asheville, spend time in Asheville. It kind of draws people in. All right, so you're a basketball player.
Yeah, I do play basketball from time to time. That's true.
You did you play for the NBA?
Yeah, I played for the Milwaukee Bucks in 2008 and the Bulls in 2009 or 2010.
Wow, you played for the Bulls in 2010. Goddamn.
Yeah, you know what's weird, Joe?
The GD Bulls.
Yes. You're right in the middle of a pretty huge sync thread that's been developing for me.
Really?
So the fact that you're on the show right now is just kind of a, you know, universal bullseye into this whole history I've been reading. Mm. And it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, it's spiraling like any good fractal is, but there's a thread inherent in it that is just pretty ridiculous. And it's all hinging upon Derrick Rose returning on February 17th.
Really? Well, I'd love to hear about it.
I can kind of take 5 minutes to sketch this out and to see what you guys think. So if you're into it, I can just let it flow for a second.
I'm totally into it.
All right, so I've been reading this book about the history of Giordano Bruno, who you can essentially translate into Jordan Brown.
Okay.
All right, so if you want to know anything about Giordano Bruno, you have to know something about John Dee, which is the great English magician, scientist, mathematician who worked in the court of Queen Elizabeth.
And William, is he related to LSD?
He is related to James Bond. He's who James Bond is based off of.
Okay.
Practically, admittedly so. John Dee's code was 007. That was his code name in the Secret Service for the Queen.
Yeah. I apologize.
No. So the lineage here goes, John Dee was probably the smartest person in the Western world in the mid-1600s, right?
Yeah.
He had the largest library in England at the time, and it was just his own personal library of like 6,000 books. And he was obviously influential enough to have direct communication with the Queen. Anyways, his writings influenced all these Renaissance hermeticists and magicians who basically fought to differentiate between good magic and demonic magic. Okay. And so essentially this is just magic and Kabbalah. And magic is just basically sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And Kabbalah is essentially kind of mathematically based psychoanalysis. That's a very quick and easy way to kind of identify it. Anyways, so that's what these cats are fighting for. But the Catholic Church is shutting it down because they want control. They don't want people being smarter or to realize what the game's all about. So that's, if you can accept that, we can move on. Anyways, so Giordano Bruno goes to Germany and inspires all these people into what they think are this group called the Giordanistes, or the Jordanaires, as I like to call them. Mm-hmm. They basically wrote the Rosicrucian literature, which inspired Freemasonry and is essentially that whole historical line of Illuminati thinking.
Right.
Okay, so this jumps right into Jordan Brown of Michael Jordan, who plays for the Chicago Bulls. He's known as Air Jordan. He's number 23, which is the number of the Illuminati, right? Mm-hmm. He's introduced every night by the track Sirius by Alan Parsons, who's producer of The Dark Side of the Moon.
Mm-hmm.
That track is from the album Eye in the Sky. Jordan's sidekick is number 33, which is the number of the Masons.
Yep.
So we have the numbers of the Masons and the Illuminati all there in Chicago with Jordan Brown or Giordano Bruno. All right, so this little dynasty, as they call it, breaks down into pieces, and the rise of the Bulls happens again when, in a 1.7% chance, which is that number 17, the Bulls win the lottery and get Derrick Rose.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So Derrick Rose went to school in Memphis, and they play basketball in a pyramid. So the whole thing about Giordano Bruno is that he wanted to resurrect, he wanted to go beyond like Hebrew Kabbalah and go into Egyptian Kabbalah, because his whole thing was that Egyptian magic and Kabbalah embraced demonic magic and understood it in a way that wasn't understood by the church. Anyways, so I'm reading all this, connecting all this, and then I'm realizing, oh, I'm talking to Joe Alexander today, who in the 1 year he played with the Bulls, I think it was the second year Derek was on there.
Yeah, he was there.
All right, so there's my 6 degrees of separation. Anyways, how do I wrap this all up? Well, the two nuggets that arise recently are that Derek Rose recently bought into Giordano's Pizza.
Did you say Rose?
Yes.
All right, here we go. You're with your Rosicrucian.
Exactly. So he buys into Giordano's Pizza, which is weird. And the rumored date of his return is February 17th, the date that Giordano Bruno was burned at the stake in front of 300,000 people 413 years ago.
Jesus. Wow.
So, okay, that's enough right there. But then I take it one step further.
Also, the Bulls, you got the Bull is Taurus, right? And Taurus is the Hierophant. Six or Vav, right? So you could take it as Hierophant and say that he's, you know, Air Jordan. It's kind of a little just playing around. Also, the Jordan in the Bible was where all of, what was it? He was like,
It's amazing because I think of you right now, Joe. I think back to another famous Chicago Bull. I think of Phil Jackson.
Right.
And I don't believe that his first book, Maverick, is still in print.
I'm not sure. I've read his other book, Sacred Hoops, but I never actually heard of Maverick.
You've never heard of Maverick?
No, it must be significantly older than...
It was written in the 70s, while he was a player in the NBA, and it pretty much was just, you know, hit... an individual talking about his life, who just happened to be an NBA player. But in it, he discussed his use of LSD. He discussed his Eastern philosophical views. And so he writes this book. And essentially, it was what led him to being blacklisted from the NBA for many, many, many years.
Because of that stuff? Or was there something?
Because of that stuff. He couldn't find a coaching job in the NBA. I think his career ran short. They didn't keep him hanging around. So he went to Canada to coach. And it wasn't until a non-publicized but pretty out-in-the-open story of Doug Collins of how he got ousted from the Chicago Bulls organization. He was the coach of the Bulls with the young Michael Jordan, who had taken him into the playoffs and seemed to be, you know, an integral part of the organization. But out of nowhere, he was fired, and in they bring Phil Jackson, who was this blacklisted, outspoken, kind of new agey guy. Mm-hmm. And then you have the run of incredible billion-dollar success. So I'm thinking that, you know, a person of your intellect, having had the kind of insight into that organization nowadays, you know, I don't know if you would have been a very popular person had you stuck around very much longer. Do you?
Right. Well, just by the nature of the things that I'm interested in, I definitely felt like I was on the outside of things. You know, the NBA is not a crowd where you can express the types of ideas that, you know, you discuss on Always Recorder and Sync Book. And just by the general nature of my interests, even if I wasn't overtly expressing them, you know, I could tell that I was on the outside. So
what is that? They just want to keep things as superficial as possible for the public's awareness or something? Like, is it, I mean, because there's the idea that, you know, sports are used as a distraction, like for Rome or Greece. You know, you have like this Colosseum that everybody goes to just, like, you know, I don't know, indulge in complete, like, removal from reality. Is that, do you feel like the reason why they don't want that is just simply for those reasons, or because it's like, is it foundationally used as a method of control? Because, I mean, I know basketball, like the origin of basketball comes from the Maya with that crazy ball that they would hit against their chest through a little hoop that was up on a wall. I don't know if that was the same premise, but what's the deal?
Yeah, I can't say completely whether it's like a, you know, a conscious effort of everyone to oust anybody who's a little bit, you know, on the fringe. But I think, at least in my case, it was more of just the social dynamic of things, where, you know, they want a cohesive team in the business sense, and they want a cohesive unit where everyone gets along, and you know, having someone like, for example, Phil Jackson in there is like, okay, this guy's stirring the pot. He's a little bit strange, and not necessarily that we don't want the fans to get wind of what he's about, but just that, you know, he doesn't kind of gel in the team, you know, if you will, like almost like if you were in a world-class business organization, you know, you can imagine yourself like, you know, you can imagine you, David, or you, Will, like walking into the boardroom meeting of all these straight-laced suits and you in the back of your mind having these fringe ideas. At some point, it's going to come out, and at some point, they're going to realize, like, okay, this dude is, you know, he's not really part of the team because he's just too weird, you know? So I think it's more of that social side of things as opposed to, like, an overarching conspiracy that we need to dumb down the populace, you know, as a medium of entertainment, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. Because that seems like that's when people go into conspiratorial ideas like this, it almost suggests that there's something in the very foundation of the thing itself, like what it's for in the first place, rather than just like we're trying to keep this team together. Because if someone's doing well, you know, but don't, like, yeah, I don't know. It's interesting.
No, I think that it's both, because I think that, you know, the conspiratorial side of it, as far as there being like this, this, you know, this conscious conspiracy to dumb down the populace and use the people that are involved, whether it's the coaches or the players, I think that that is a conspiracy, but it's more of a conspiracy of like more of a mysterious force. So I like to say that it's both, you know, I'm sure you're both familiar with that. Like,
sure.
You know, it's, yeah. So.
I think maybe they're both happening at the same time.
But, you know, it's so bizarre because Phil Jackson and his coaching staff, they instituted the triangle offense, which was the cornerstone of those championships.
Right.
You know, and it took a certain type of player to be able to work inside the triangle offense. And where did Phil Jackson institute the triangle offense after Chicago? He goes to L.A. And he wins another. I think he won six championships or five with L.A. He won five.
Yeah.
But, you know, the coincidence just keeps piling and piling and piling up. We were discussing a couple weeks ago the notion of the shooter's touch, which is, you know, the good shooter will get the mysterious bounce that puts the ball in the basket. And, you know, someone like Kubrick in his films, he'll get the luxury of the perfect sync happening in his movie outside of his control that
right.
that enhances the whole mystique and the product.
Yeah.
And I think that's definitely what happens when organizations and organizationally complex thought meet head-to-head, even in something seemingly as innocent as a game of basketball. But I think what these things do is they make you realize that there's nothing simple or innocent at all about something like the NBA and basketball. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of what you choose to pay attention to.
Yeah, I want to jump into that too, because it's interesting that you mentioned the shooter's touch, because I feel like every basketball player at a high level, they're in tune with this sort of this very esoteric notion of manifesting, you know, whatever it is that you have at the forefront of your mind, but they don't even know it. Because, like, even in the NBA and even when I was in college, the idea that coaches teach you to shoot is, and to get that shooter's touch, is that after you release the ball, you have to hold in your mind the vision or the intention of the ball going in the basket. And if you ever let go of it, if you ever let go of that intention, then you lower or you decrease your shooting percentage. And I'm talking about after the ball leaves your hand. And so even though all the other players, and I'm assuming the coaches too, you know, they all interpret this as, well, you know, holding on to that intention and preparing to do that has an effect before you release the ball. You know, the habit of holding that intention affects the ball before you release it, you know, because you're in preparation to hold that intention. But the way I've interpreted it and the way I really believe that it works is that, you know, the more the more esoteric notion of that, when you have an intention in your mind, it manifests in physical reality. And I think that basketball players are demonstrating that and doing it every day, like you said, with the touch around the rim. I know that it might sound a little crazy and far-fetched, but that's how I interpret it. And I've experienced it firsthand. Like, when you really hold that intention, and I'm talking about the ball is out of your hands, it's on the rim, if you hold it in your mind and you sort of follow through in your brain, you know, your shooting percentage goes up. So I think it's a strange phenomenon, but it's a good example of how, you know, your intentions are manifested. So
I think that that's why a lot of professional athletes are such intense gamblers, because nothing will demonstrate that kind of concept more profoundly than gambling.
Right.
Because especially when you come head to head with someone else and you're both extending your intention as much as you can, that to, you know, come out on top, to take that other person's money, it was never about the money. It was just about dominance. You know, it's that alpha male into a sort of esoteric realm. And yep, whether or not they really, really recognize it, it doesn't really matter. It's right there in their actions.
No, you're absolutely right. We used to gamble constantly. I mean, it's all we did. When we weren't playing basketball, obviously we were together all the time, except when we were on road trips. But all we did together was gamble. And it became very apparent to me that there's a distinct culture in pro sports. And the number one aspect of that culture is one of just constantly sharpening your tools for dominating other people and for being the alpha male and for competing. And I found that, you know, at the higher level of sports, competing is beyond competing. It's about complete dominance. You know, like when you're young, you learn that sports is about competing with other people and being sportsmanlike and trying to win. But at the higher levels, it's about dominance. You know, that's your goal. And you're absolutely right. Like when we would travel around, all we do is play poker all day, or we play other kinds of gambling games nonstop. And you can just tell by the way people talk, by the way people act, by just everything about the situation. It's about sharpening your tools and sharpening your taste and your thirst for dominating other people. And so that was something that I noticed really early. Go ahead.
There's an argument for when you let go of the ball and you're still making the shot, even though it's completely out of your hands, that even though, you know, at the rim, if it's bouncing around and it happens to go in, you feel that your mind made it to go in. If you start out with the attitude of looking at it in that way from the get-go, the actual, like, letting go of the ball, like, that's, there's an argument for why that would actually work, because that's a whole attitude that's going into your shot. I mean, you know, like, because you're treating it in that way, it's like, when I was in massage school, you know, they would have this whole thing where you have an electromagnetic field around your body. They were very practical about it, but they were like, this is not like a new agey kind of idea. This is a fact. You know, you don't stop at your skin. And when you're approaching somebody, you're supposed to hold that awareness that as soon as you go within their field, you're already affecting them. You know, we're all affecting each other on that level. And so it makes sense that if you're, you know, releasing a ball from your hands with an intention, of course, when you're already like setting the attitude that you don't stop at your fingers, you're setting yourself up for a right kind of relationship with the group. You know? That makes sense.
You know, I was I played high school golf, and what you were saying, Joe, is exactly what the culture was on our team when we essentially when we weren't at a meet, everything revolved around gambling. You know, when we were at the driving range, it would be hit your bucket of balls so you could go to the putting green, and we would just gamble on the putting green. And these guys took it to the level where, you know, you'd go to lunch after practice or whatever, and they'd be at the table and be like, $25, I can throw my cup into the garbage can from here. And they would just be gambling nonstop on every single action. And it was actually one of the greatest courses or educations I ever got, because I had to learn how to survive. It was almost as if my position on the team rested on how well I assimilated into that off-the-course culture. Because if I couldn't participate in the gambling, if I couldn't at least win some of the time, then I wouldn't have any money to participate in the gambling. And if I couldn't participate in the gambling, then I was essentially dead. And so it forced me to, you know, I didn't have any books, and I couldn't go to anyone I knew on how to figure what that was all about. I was just alone with my own deficiencies there. And when you're forced into a position of survival, you know, usually the human being responds in a positive way. So, you know, I eventually learned how to hold my own, and I'm grateful for that opportunity, because I think that it doesn't have to be sinister. See, that's the thing, I think, with Giordano Bruno, and why he was so dangerous and so reviled in the history of the evolution of all this stuff that we talk about, is that he embraced all those things that people would immediately brand as demonic magic.
Mm.
He didn't see a distinction between good natural magic or demonic magic. He just thought it was all magic, and that the true magician needed to open themselves up to all of these things in an effort to hone and sharpen the mind so that you could establish that connection with the Most High. So it's a very delicate conversation, and it just shows you the power of words, I guess. When the moment you label something as demonic magic, you lose more than half of the people right there.
Right, but also the power structure itself that was looking to repress that. I mean, they're the ones emphasizing this kind of superstitious way of looking at the thing. Like, you're talking about people who are into sports who are also into gambling, but their relationship to gambling is one of confidence, power of influence, rather than simply their superstition, like carrying around rabbit's feet. They're like recognizing their abilities beyond the perceptual level, you know, expressing that there's a higher degree of influential capacity. So that's a little different. I mean, when you look at the history, like R.E.A. Kaplan's, you got the Sefer Yetzirah, Bill?
Yes, I did.
He's got, there's another book, Kabbalah and Meditation, where he talks about the history of what the Kabbalists had to go through in order to maintain the text and the tradition. And it's pretty fucking horrific. Like, it's like it explains to a high degree the need for secrecy, which I don't think exists the way that it used to exist. We have entirely different reasons now for things being kept secret, which is rather unfortunate, because you can see that a lot of it was secret out of necessity because of people's own fears is one level of it, like what you're saying with the people's ideas around demonic or anything of that nature. But then it's also just power structure. Like you actually said at the beginning of the conversation that, you know, it's people's, need to maintain a degree of control at a higher level, and you don't want people realizing their own psychic powers and utilizing them, you know?
I like this. And I think there's another interesting side to this whole, like, you know, labeling something demonic. And, you know, because I feel like the act of just saying something is demonic or condemning it actually makes it demonic. Because you affect the psyche of people who have no real involvement in the thing that you're labeling besides your opinion of it. So if your opinion of it that you convey to them is, well, this is demonic, you know, they might have no other access to that entity other than your label. And so in that sense, like if you were to just say like, you know, so such and such group, like for Scientology is a great example, like for, you know, you label Scientology as demonic, well, suddenly they become demonic in the eyes of, let's say, hundreds of millions of people. And that act of labeling them demonic actually becomes, you know, the sort of spell, if you will. Like, you know, they might not actually be a demonic, like, entity, you know, doing strange dark magic. But the person who labels them demonic, he's actually the quote, dark magician, or, you know, because he creates...
I like that.
Yeah, because he creates that perspective in the mind of observers who have no idea what they're looking at. And so, like, you could take the opposite and say, well, you know, then somebody who labels something as not demonic or labels something as positive, like, then they're the magician of light or whatever you want to call it. But it's just that the simple act of labeling it either good or bad. Like, that's the magic involved. You know, it's not the actual thing. The actual thing has no, like, no abstract magical properties. It's the abstract nature of the person who labels it. You know, that's where the magic is.
Well, I think at one time that it actually served a different kind of function, and our current connotation that we give to it is a big misunderstanding. Like, the idea of cliphotic energy, like the clipo, the shell that surrounds the tree of life, you know, spiritual influence, but it's like almost like the idea of like lost souls or whatever, you know. Idea served a function because you were aware that these things required responsibility. Like, to get into these practices requires a high degree of awareness and acting from a higher intelligence, and not simply to be like the sorcerer's apprentice and throw on the hat and then make a bunch of chaos. You know, it's like a gizmo in Gremlins. You know, Mogwai literally translates in Chinese as demon, you know, and he's just this little creature. And he's like, with the Mogwai comes responsibility. You got to know these three things, and you got to do it. You got to take care of it right. And if you don't care for it right, then it just, the problems multiply like the brooms in Fantasia. You know, it spirals out of control. And it becomes more than you're able to deal with. And so I do think that there is something to that. And for lack of a better word, you could go ahead and call that demonic. But I think that we used to have a different relationship to those kind of ideas, if that makes sense.
No, yeah, definitely. I think that, like you said, you know, you have a responsibility with this demon. Like, one of the responsibilities, I would say, is to not inspire fear in the minds of others, because to me that really is where the magic takes place. Like, that is where when you create fear in the mind of other people, or you create a perception in other people's minds that a demon even exists, you know, that's where the problems arise, not in the actual, like, demon itself, you know, because the demon itself is nothing. It doesn't, unless its intentions are truly, like, to cause bad. I'm saying that, you know, pretend that the supposed demon isn't really an evil entity, or it's not out to institute chaos. You know, the chaos is created, and the evil is actually created when you create in the mind of observers that this is a demonic entity, that it exists. So I would say that, like, as far as responsibility goes, you know, that's your responsibility, is to portray this supposedly evil entity in a positive light and allow others to understand it as a potential force for good.
We have Mr. Alan Green on the line, I believe.
I am. Yes, I am here. Joe, good to hear your voice. I mean, good to hear all your voices, but...
Hi, Alan. How you doing, man?
Good. Sorry. I really think I'm in... There's, like, something crazy following me around.
Because you called in at 42 minutes, by the way.
Oh, wonderful. I made it. We're back in Virginia. We just came back from North Carolina, and then last night there was like these crazy, like, hurricane winds, and there's no phone service here because
you're
the power line.
You're in Virginia now.
Yeah.
Okay. Where are you living? I thought you were, like, moving to North Carolina.
I am. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, as I'm saying, so I went. Oh, it does. I don't mean to interrupt the flow of this conversation, but just basically that there is some. I don't think it's bad juju. I just think it's some heavy juju following me around.
Probably demon.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Alan, where did you say you are? You're in Virginia.
Right now, I'm in Virginia. So, I mean, I've lived in New York all my life, and then my wife has family in Virginia that we were staying with. So we for the last month, and we spent I guess like 2.5 weeks in Virginia. Then we went to look at a place in North Carolina, thinking about moving there. So we spent a week in North Carolina. And then we left all our stuff here. We just went there for a week just to see if we could find an apartment and find jobs and things like that, and just to see sort of what was there in North Carolina for us, see if we even liked it. And we just got back from there. And basically, we're just now figuring out how to get our stuff from here back down there when we leave. So probably heading back to North Carolina this weekend.
Nice. Right. You're in the middle. You're in transition mode. It's like the most goddamn stressful time there is. Have
pretty,
fun with
pretty
that.
Much. But, you know, so, it, you know, here's the thing. So you guys are talking about demons. So there is very specifically, this came to me as like, as 2012 was winding down, everything that kept like really sinking heavy for me was this idea of Turin Zone, you know, this idea of the dweller on the threshold, sometimes demon, all this sort of stuff, 333, you know, Dark Night of the Soul, all this stuff. Now, of course, Joe, you made your video of the Dark Rift of the Soul. Maybe we can kind of see where this overlaps. But what I'm saying is 2012 is winding down. I know I'm heading for some weird Dark Night of the Soul, and I'm trying to figure out what does that even mean. And I'm thinking of it in intellectual abstract terms, and but no, I mean, this is very embodied. It's like there are things happening to me, and it actually started just mere minutes before my 32nd birthday. Like, basically, I got this phone call at like 10 p.m. on December 30th. My birthday is December 31st. It was like the final day and 2 hours of 2012, and it's just hours before my birthday, but notably my 32nd birthday. Well, there's 32 paths, right? So, right. Like, here's this idea of, like, nearing some sort of weird completion. We have the, you know, Terrence McKenna time wave. We have 32 paths. All this, like weird correspondence of coming to some sort of completion and the hardship just before. And that's what I'm going through right now. So it's very interesting time in my life.
I've been studying the book of Ezekiel with my rabbi, and the statement that was made about the idea that there's a storm coming, like Catwoman says in the new Batman, and the repeated references to the storm and connecting that with the Dark Knight. And then looking at the book of Ezekiel, he has to go through the storm wind, which all the Kabbalistic commentary around has that's the levels of the klipot. Those are the shells protecting the sacred, right? So he goes through these levels, and then he like sees the seraphim, which are basically the four fixed signs, the zodiac, and sees how they're influencing the planet. That there's a line from the planet to the seraphim and all of this. But just this idea of piercing this veil, this storm veil, has just been on my mind like crazy. That you reach, like, and this is also spoken of in Samkhya, or at least Patanjali, with the idea of the higher states of samadhi. Actually, the point at which the gravity leads you inevitably towards further liberation when the discriminative intellect really gets rolling is actually referred to as a cloud pouring virtue, or a cloud that's like giving you nourishing you in a different kind of way. And so I don't know, I see it interesting that there's whenever fear arises in one's practice, that's usually a good sign if you're facing it. You know, if you're running from it, that might be a different story. But if you're, you know, taking it on, that's something else.
Yeah. And that's go ahead, Joe. Yeah.
No, I was real quick going to say it reminds me of in the Neverending Story when the inability for people to create by, you know, using their imaginations is, you know, personified as a called the nothing.
Oh.
and they good. Can't get rid of it until they realize once again their own ability to manifest by just thinking.
Yeah. It gets to me how in the film The Neverending Story, they never actually explain to you why it's a never-ending story, whereas German book by Michael Ende, which is funny that his last name is Ende and he wrote The Neverending Story, they express why it is actually, why in order for him to go back to the quote-unquote real world, he has to allow the story to keep going on its own, which is basically keeping out the nothing. It's the idea that the stories are, you know, what are keeping, you know, Fantastica together is like so crucial for this plane. Like, people see them as these isolated things, but they're not. There's a distinction, but there's no separation between Fantastica and this realm. And in order to keep that relationship going, you need stories. It's like Dr. Parnassus, when Tom Waits walks into his place and everyone's he's like, well, what if everyone stops saying the story, and then nothing stops, and he's like, somebody's still saying a story, you know?
Right. It's like the story is like the brick wall or the wall that the vine has to grow on. It's like the reality can't exist without that sort of material for it to envelop and to grow upon.
Professional sports are kind of like a never-ending story, and that, you know, it just, there's never really a distinction from the narrative of the beginning of the season to the end of the season, and that it just, it is basically a soap opera for guys, because it's just drama after drama after drama, and if you spend enough time watching it, at a certain point you just go, I've seen this before, this is bullshit. And the whole idea is that if, let's say, something like the NFL ceased to exist, that doesn't mean that football has ceased to exist. It just means that this sort of entity that contains football would cease to exist. So professional sports kind of have this stamp as being the pinnacle of an athletic, something that, you know, some kind of sport. But really, to get rid of it would not damage the sport in any way, because yeah. It is a child's game. It really isn't, you know, crucial to an adult livelihood, right? I mean, it's a luxury on some level. It's an opiate for the masses, but it doesn't depend on whether we live or die to have Major League Baseball go into its 200th year. And we can see all the bullshit that infects these organizations the longer they go on. Especially now with the NFL and concussions and the fact that who's going to want their kid to play football? It's not about the concussions that they get in the NFL. What about the 3 or 4 concussions they get in high school that prevents them from going to college? So that's going to – these systems inherently, if there's something wrong with the system, it'll manifest itself eventually. So I don't know.
Yeah, I like that. It's like the sport is almost a storyline. Like you could look at it similar to the Greek mythology or any mythology, how it's almost like the people observing the stories, they just have a need, almost like a therapeutic need, to engage in dramatic stories. Maybe it's to fuel their need to gain experience in life, because, you know, you gain wisdom by having experiences, and you can either go out and physically have those experiences, or you can just indulge and listen to storylines, and you can gain your experience by observing other characters go through their ups and downs. And I think that, you know, that need is fulfilled by, like, observing a Greek style you know, mythology, where you have the storylines of all these different gods going through their ups and downs and their trials. But then, you know, in modern times, for people who don't have those types of storylines, you have sports, like you said. Like, and a lot of people, you know, as evidence to serve this, you know, they don't even really follow the sport, or they don't even really care about the intricacies of the skills involved or what the players are about. They're just more interested in the soap opera aspect of it, you know?
Absolutely. I think that's perfectly demonstrated by a sport like golf, where television ratings, which is the driving factor behind all of these professional organizations, television ratings go down when Tiger Woods is not in the tournament. Well, is Tiger Woods golf? Is golf dependent upon Tiger Woods? No, but television ratings, the casual observer who doesn't play golf is more likely to tune in to see that individual, because it's sort of like Zeus, or in the mythology, you know, the main guy is in the story. Right. The drama is heightened in some way, and people are really tuning in to see something related to that, which is completely unrelated to a tournament based around playing golf. So
totally. and I love to use sports as like a foundation for allowing people to understand like what storylines and mythologies are all about. Like, because you know, if you try to explain the mythology of like a specific god or a specific entity to somebody, they'll say, you know, it doesn't make any sense. You know, like he's associated with all these different things. Like he's associated with the color blue, and he's associated with the lightning bolt, and sudden associated with like the rat or whatever, and they're like, you know, this doesn't make any sense. Like, but you can use sports as like an example for that. Like, for example, imagine in like a couple centuries down the road, someone looks back at the archives of what happens in sports of today, and they see like, oh, this character Kobe, you know, he was this mythical god associated with lakes, you know, because he played for the Lakers. But they wouldn't know the details like that. They would just know what he was associated with. So they'd be like, well, he's associated with lakes, but he's also associated with the black snake of Africa, you know, because his nickname is the Mamba. And so they would have all these different associations. So you can see how, like, the mythology would develop over time, and you would have these characters attributed to these certain aspects. And so
I'm looking at Nike right now, the god Nike, and just, like, I was thinking about Air Jordan and just how funny it is, like, the whole – like, when I was in school, if somebody had Air Jordans, there was, like, knockoff Air Jordans, and everyone could tell, and they'd be like, oh, those are a knockoff. And then, like, it was a big deal if you wore Air Jordans. But I'm looking at Nike here, and it's like Nike flew around battlefields rewarding the victors with glory and fame. And what has Nike done but awarded the victors with glory and fame? And if you look at it like that, the you know, that the game is the battlefield, you know, he's going out there, and once you get picked up by Nike, are basically getting just that. It's so funny.